time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
Welcome to the show. I have a special show for you today. I am very honored and privileged to have jazz legend Terry Gibbs with me today. Terry, I'm so happy that you're here to do the show. And I'm gonna just jump in with you because you can talk. I know you can talk.
You're gonna jump in where with me?
Anywhere you want, Terry, because you're fantastic.
No, go ahead. Keep going, Laurie. I'm just being silly. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. I read your phenomenal book called Good Vibes, and I felt like I lived your life with you as I was reading through the book. As a matter of fact, the goodbye...
I bet you got to be tired, right? I really, at 90 years old, I have just a big life.
Yeah, you did. I lived through most of those 90 years with you, but I did it in 4 days. It was great, just going through the stories that you told. You're an excellent storyteller. So I want to start at the beginning, because that's always the best place to start. You're from New York. Tell me about music.
Actually, Brooklyn, I'm actually from Brooklyn, New York. There's a big difference, you come from New York, but the big difference between what they call Brooklyn and the Bronx. That was a feud. But go ahead, I'm from Brooklyn, yes.
Okay, well, I gave it generic. I know, like, yeah, the Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, you know, they were all different back then, right? I mean, they kind of were their own neighborhoods.
In those days, it was like, well, mostly Brooklyn and the Bronx, it was a dumb feud because the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Giants, we had all the baseball teams. And so if you came from Brooklyn, if you were a Brooklyn Dodger fan, if you came from New York, if you were a New York Giant fan, and you hated each other for dumb reasons.
Okay, well, tell me about music in your family life.
Well, my father was a band leader playing Jewish weddings and bar mitzvahs. He was very successful doing that, and so was my brother. And I grew up in a family I had two sisters that played music. One actually studied singing, and the other one played piano, but not professionally in any other way. You know, they weren't really that good. But my brother, my brother was really great. He also played the same instruments I do.
Okay.
And so actually music was secondary to me at the time, because actually I was a very good athlete. I wanted to be a boxer as a young kid.
Yeah, and when I spoke to you, when we spoke a few days ago on the phone, you said that music was not really planned, right? It wasn't a planned thing for you.
No, nothing. My whole life was never planned. I never really had what you call goals, Lori. I just lucked into a whole bunch of different things, and whatever I lucked into, I really must have done the job, or I wouldn't have been where I am now.
Well, what made you decide that you wanted to learn? You played drums, you played vibes. What made you decide? Was it just because, you know, your family was into it? It was kind of a natural thing to do?
Actually, Lori, I play all the percussion. I had a scholarship to Juilliard as a timpanist in playing in the symphony. But my brother had the xylophones in the house. And when he wasn't around, I'd go over and I'd doodle with them. You know, I would fool with them. And one time when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I went to visit him in what they call the Catskill Mountains, which they used to have shows in there. And I visited him. They used to have an amateur hour on a Monday. So when my brother wasn't around, once again, I'd sneak in the casino, and I would fool with it, and I learned a song called The Boulevard of Broken Dreams. And a rich lady came in and heard me doodling. She said, "Well, you got to do that in the amateur." I said, "Well, forget it. I don't tell my brother because he'll be mad as heck at me." And she said, "You got to do it anyhow." My sister, who was visiting that weekend, they told her I was going to play in the amateur hour, and everybody thought I was crazy. My brother says, "He never played. What do you mean he's going to play?" Anyway, I played in the amateur hour, and my sister thought that I was good, really good, and so she got me a teacher, and from there on in, I actually studied legitimately for a year, but it all came natural to me, Laurie. For example, my teacher would give me a lesson, and he said, "You understand?" And I played right back for him. So he'd give me another lesson. Sometimes he'd give me 8 or 10 lessons in one, and I memorized it all immediately.
So do you have perfect pitch, Terry? I mean, I know a lot of people who are musical, they can just hear it and play it. They don't need to read anything. So you were able to do that.
Seriously, thank God I don't have perfect. I have relative, what they call relative pitch. Okay. I can almost hear the note and play it. Because if I had perfect pitch playing the vibraphones, I'd be in a lot of trouble because there are a lot of pianos that are not in tune, really strictly in tune, and that could hurt your ear. You know, having perfect pitch is a good thing and a bad thing because if you're a piano player and people play out of tune with you, it hurts your ear.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you were playing. You got into this radio show contest when you were, what, 12?
I was 12 years old. Actually, it was called the Major Bowes Amateur Hour. And Lori, that show was the biggest show on radio. It was bigger on radio those days because there's no television than American Idol was in television in this country. And I hate to, put it this way, but the talent that won the Major Bowes Amateur Hour was a lot better than the talent. Well, for an example, Frank Sinatra won the Major Bowes Amateur Hour. You've never had a singer on American Idol that has ever come up to a Frank Sinatra.
Right.
So that's how it goes.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. Because
I won the Major Bowes Amateur. I went on the road at 12 years old. I went on the road. I had a tutor. Well, we played theaters those days.
Well, I mean, that's fantastic that you won that contest. Now, it was funny when we talked over the weekend, you know that I'm Jewish. So you changed your name, because when I read your book, you changed your name from a Jewish name to a more Americanized name.
It's a Russian name. My legal name is Gubenko, and I didn't change it. I went with, this is 1939 or 40. I was playing drums with a girl band here. And first of all, the name Terry, it was a nickname. You know, when you're a kid, and if you play baseball, and if you look like Babe Ruth, the kids call you Babe, they give you a nickname. So Terry, there was a fighter called Terry Young that I liked, that I used to try to emulate. And Nick Terry became a nickname. But now, I went with this band leader, and the publicity was going to be, they were featuring Terry Benko on drums and xylophones, and the publicity came back saying Terry Gibbs. I thought I got fired, and they came and told me that, well, the name is too long for the marquee now, which was a bunch of baloney because those days ethnic names weren't the thing to put in. But it's amazing because Benny Goodman, who is Jewish, the name Goodman is Jewish. Artie Shore changed his name. I think his name was Shostevsky or something. But Artie Shore changed his name. But I didn't change my name, actually, until about 20, 30 years later, because when I started to make the name Terry Gibbs a little well-known, and I started to get a little money, I make a will and trust, you have to have, it can be kind of confusing, so I legally changed it to Gibbs.
I gotcha. But, going back in time, you were talking a little bit. Why did people change their names back then in the 30s and 40s? If you were a performer, was it more of a, they wanted to make it a more generic name so there was no religion associated with it? What was the reason that
people
did that?
Well, of course, Jews weren't the cup of tea those days. Black people and Jews weren't your favorite people to be with, unless you were on stage.
All right. Now, talk about a little bit about who some of your teachers were and how they influenced you to the sound that you
have. I had one teacher who I studied music with.
Okay.
But actually, as a young person, I my first idols were, I play all the percussion, so I told you that.
Yeah.
And I, as a drummer, Joe Jones is a drummer that played with Count Basie and the great Buddy Rich. They were a big influence on me, and it came to a musical instrument. Roy Eldridge and Lester Young were my influence, and then later on in life, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell became my biggest influences. So I got a chance to play with all of them, which was wonderful. Everybody I saw, Benny Goodman, all these people that were people that influenced me, I got a chance to play with and become friends with and be respected by it, which was great.
Well, what we're going to do, we're going to play an audio clip of you playing. So hang on for just
What song are you going to play?
I'll tell you in just a second.
I'm not going to wait.
You have to wait. Hang on 1 second. We're going to pull it up here.
It's a Terry Gibbs Quartet.
One second. Nothing can be done in 1 second.
Okay, yeah. It's the Terry Gibbs Quartet. Does it give a song?
It doesn't give a song.
Tonight Show, 1956. Does that ring a bell?
Here we go.
Yeah, that's cool.
Terry, that song was called Gibberish, right?
I know it. I wrote it.
Right. You know, what inspires you to write songs like that?
Well, you just, whatever comes into your head. You know, as a jazz musician, every jazz musician should be a writer, because what they're doing when you're playing jazz, you whatever melody you're playing, there are what they call chord changes underneath the melody, and
right,
which the song is built on, and whatever you hear in your head, whatever thing you play should be a song. You should be playing songs so that for example, to me, Charlie Parker, whatever he played, no matter if it was fast or slow, whatever, if you slow down the fast ones, you could write a lyric to everything he played. So
yeah,
when you play something melodic and you hear something melodic, whatever comes out of your head. And the funniest thing is, it's day-to-day how your brain thinks when you're playing jazz, because you're improvising. You're making it up as you go along. You know, from playing the vibes, from where I hear that note up in my head, a billionth or maybe 20, a trillionth of a second, it's got to go to your hand right to the note and hit it immediately. And if you're playing a lot of notes, those trillions of seconds go by pretty fast, you know. And so that's the jazz is something, and one night you may feel it, you may hear it, and maybe second night you won't hear it as well. If you're a good instrumentalist, to the audience, you'll never sound bad, because you're not flubbing on the instrument, you're playing the instrument, but to yourself. And the most important thing to me is I've gotten standing ovations and got off the stage feeling terrible, because I didn't think I felt like I played anything different today than I did last night on the same song. And I go back to my room feeling terrible, standing ovation or not, because I don't play for an audience. I hope they like what I do. I play for me. I got to have fun playing, and I have to like what I'm doing. Otherwise, I'm a salesman, you know.
Right, you're just selling the same old stuff, but your stuff is different. And so when you go out and improvise, you know, could it be a different thing each time you go out and perform it?
Every time I play the same song is different, completely different. The melody may be the same, but every jazz thing, you know what's the hardest thing to do, Laurie? I like recording live. Now, you know, and when you play live, when you're recording live, whatever you get, that's there. You can't edit, you can't forward, you can't do anything, because day to day the tempo has changed. So you have to pick what you think is the best of your solos. And every time you listen, they're all different. Well, I'll tell you one thing that will show you something. I produced a record date for, we did a tribute to Benny Goodman with Buddy DeFranco on clarinet and Herb Ellis on guitar. And Milt Hinton on bass. We did this, and Butch Miles on drums, and Larry Novak on piano, and we played for 3 days. Now, I produced the date, so I had to go edit the thing. Now, there was one song, I'm not going to mention it because I don't want people to hear it, but this one song I had to pick. One night, the whole band played great, and the ending was great. It was powerful. Everybody played great jazz, but I didn't play good. But on the other take, the other night, I played great, but it wasn't a good take. And now I wasn't an instrumentalist anymore. I was a producer. And I had to pick the one where I didn't play good and everybody else played good. So, you know, you never know what you're going to play when you're doing it live.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm a classical pianist, and so for me, jazz is opposite everything that
I do.
You
play the same thing every time you play it. You know,
yes.
There's a certain feeling you have to put to it. That's why of all these classical piano players who play the same song, why is one better than the other? Technically, if they all play it, because there's a certain feel that you put into it that belongs to you, that comes out of your soul, you know?
Right. But what you do is you go outside the box. You know, if classical is in the box, in jazz, you're outside that box.
You're playing the same notes all the time. In jazz, you don't play the... if you play the same notes, you're not a good jazz player.
Gotcha. Well, you know, in your book, you talked about playing bebop and swing. So what makes their sounds unique?
I hate to interrupt you.
Sure.
I hate names really giving it music, but that's what the music of the Charlie Parker era was called, compared to the big band era of Benny Goodman and Count Basie and Artie Shaw, Duke Ellington, a whole bunch of people. You know, there's a cliche. I think Duke Ellington wrote a song, or somebody wrote it. It's called... It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Oh, yeah, I know that, yep.
Any type of music that swings is fun to play with somebody who does that. Now, bebop was... The only thing that we had bebop and what they call swing music, where there was a little different change, was the syncopation of the music. The maybe the articulation a little bit changed, but the notes were all the same. It's all according to how you played it. Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie started... A new way of playing it that was very melodic, and you had to be technically a very good musician. You had to know harmony and theory, in and out and in and out, to play the song. And you know, the more I played a song, the better I played it. And it's almost like a marriage. When you marry somebody, the longer you live with them, you find out how they are, where they where they put their toothpaste or whatever they do, and you know you can find out and you'll get along better. Same thing with a song. The more you play it, the more you know about the thing, the more you hear it, you get to know it better, you can play it better. You can play it better because you know where you whatever you hear, you know where to go more, you know? It may be hard to tell somebody about it, but that's how it is, though.
All right. Well, one of the things you talked about in your book, and I guess I should be, you know, I was surprised to hear that a lot of famous musicians did heavy drugs. You talk about that, and they did it while they were performing.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
The era before me, they all drank. The musicians drank, you know. In my era, unfortunately, and you know, indirectly, Charlie Parker, indirectly, let me keep saying that, because in a way he was to blame, because he was so good. He was the only genius I can think of in jazz. He was that much of a genius and unfortunately he was hooked on dope since he was 15, that everybody thought because he made heroin and played so great, nobody can play that good and different. They'll do, maybe it's heroin that did it, so they got hooked on heroin. But it didn't make you play any better. And Charlie Parker didn't even want you to do it when you played with him. He didn't want you to. He was just hooked. But it had nothing to do with anybody playing better. In fact, it never made you play worse either, because I think a good musician is into the music. You know what happens with dope? Luckily, I never did any hard dope. When I talked about it, I always said that... there were three things I've always been first of all, I'm a stupid person in my younger days because I didn't have fear. If somebody 9 foot tall wanted to fight me, I'd fight them. The only thing I was actually afraid was a knife and a gun and a needle. So if I had to go to the doctor to get a shot of penicillin in my fanny, he had to catch me before he'd get that needle in me. I was that afraid of a needle, and that's one of the reasons why I never made any dope. I never fooled it.
Yeah, and I don't blame you. So, I mean, I don't even know what to say to it, because when I read it, I went, you know, maybe it was a common thing, but you don't think of it so much.
You know, you're in the air right now with all these young kids that are sniffing anything you can get. You know, they're making millions of dollars, and it doesn't mean anything, but it costs to buy that dope. They can afford it, so they're doing it.
Yeah.
But this era, I hate to say it, this era is not as talented as the one before them.
Right. Well, I favor the 30s, 40s, and 50s myself as far as the style of music and the quality of musicians and performers you had back then. There was nothing else like it.
Close the show right now, what you just said.
Yeah. Not yet, though. Don't go anywhere, Terry.
You said the right thing. 30s, 40s, and 50s was the greatest era of jazz, anyhow.
Yep. Now, you eventually became a band leader yourself, and I know you headed up Mel Torme's TV show band. So why don't you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was pretty wild. We did the first color television show. I was actually the band leader with his, we were co-leaders with his piano player, who was his accompanist. And there was a color television show we did in 1950, which I think the sets were about like 4 inches by 4 inches those days. But color television was brand new. But I became a band leader, and then I would give up my band every once in a while to go with Benny Goodman, who was like in the 30s and 40s, he was probably more famous in around the world than the president of the United States, because swing music was the pop music of the day. You go into what they call candy stores those days, where they sold ice cream and candies, penny candies, and everybody had a jukebox. And every jukebox you'd hear Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, every band. That was the pop music of the day.
Now, you talked about Benny Goodman a lot, and I always loved Benny Goodman and his style of playing. But in your book, you actually did a second chapter on him called El Fago. So why I enjoyed that, but you share that.
But the first one could have been called El Fago, too. Benny Goodman, he lived the clarinet. He couldn't remember anybody's name, and he called everybody Pops. He Pops. He actually loved my last name, Gubenko, my real name. He called me Gubenko until I asked him for a raise, and I became Pops.
Yeah, and you said
that was his thing.
And you mentioned he practiced naked?
Yeah, one time we were on the road, and this guy, Don Elliott, who I got into the band, he wanted to draw some money, so I said, well, let's go up to Benny's room. He said, really? He said, come on, we'll go up to his room. And Benny was practicing. We always practice. And he's playing the clarinet in a room, and I knocked on the door, and he stopped playing. He said, who's there? I said, it's Gubenko. He said, come on in. I come in, he's standing there completely naked practicing. I didn't know where to look. it's embarrassing. I looked up in the air. Donnell, he was looking on the floor, and we're trying to get some money.
That's funny. He could have covered himself with his clarinet, right? But he didn't do that.
No, he didn't care. Benny was left field. He probably didn't know he was naked. Before I ever played for Benny Goodman, I hear stories that, for example, I told you this guy wore a pair of black shoes, and then you told to another person who told to another person. By the time 18th person came around and came back to me, it was a red sweater. Because how stories all screw up, Well, with Benny Goodman, he was so in left field. I used to hear these stories, and I figured, nobody could be this out. Nobody living could be this foggy. And until I worked with him, I found out every story I ever heard about him is true. I wrote some funny stories about him in the book because, you know what's wild about my book, Lori? If I were to write about you, nobody would know these stories but you and I. These are all my personal stories of the dealings I have to do with all these very talented, famous people. Working with them or for them, whatever. When I worked with Steve Allen for 17 years, that was like a blessing, and then all those things that I ever did. I'm a blessed human being.
You are, and I don't want you to go anywhere.
We're gonna blessed human being for being 90 years old and be able to talk to you. Are you kidding?
You're sharp as a tack wall. Don't go anywhere, Terry. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a second, okay?
I'm leaving, Laura.
No, don't leave.
Okay.
Don't leave. Hang on.
Our highly competitive and hectic world is fraught with dishonesty and challenges. Critical decisions must be made on a daily basis with accuracy when substantial assets are at risk. When you are confronted with a decision point involving opportunity and risk, consult with Sharpline Investigations, statewide experts in due diligence, investigations, and litigation support. Sharpline's professionals work with clients to conduct interviews, deep background investigations, and develop facts and intelligence related to litigation. When circumstances require confidential and expert fact-finding, turn to Sharpline Investigations, the statewide leaders in investigations and risk mitigation. Visit sharplineinvestigations.com or call 855-394-0042.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664. Today. That's 813-935-1664 and get on track to better health.
Are your credit reports a mess? Are debt collectors hounding you? Maybe you're in foreclosure or headed towards foreclosure and don't know where to turn. It's time to stop panicking. Take back control of your life. Make the first step by calling Credit Education Consultants today at 813-500-6064. That's 813-500-6064. Mention the word radio for a free 15-minute consultation. Don't delay. Call today.
Did you know there's a sprawling botanical paradise right in your own backyard? Come visit Sunken Gardens. Located at 1825 4th Street North, it's St. Petersburg's oldest living museum. This 100-year-old garden is home to some of the oldest tropical plants in the region. Unwind as you stroll through meandering paths, lush with exotic plants from around the world. Explore cascading waterfalls, beautiful demonstration gardens, and more than 50,000 tropical plants and flowers. Sunken Gardens provides garden tours, horticultural programs, special events, field trips, weddings, private or corporate rentals, and much more. Call 727-551-3102 for more information. That's 727-551-3102. Sunken Gardens, 1825 4th Street North, right in the heart of Old Northeast St. Petersburg. Call 727-551-3102.
What's your IRS problem? Do you owe back taxes? Is there a lien placed on your property? Have your bank accounts been frozen or seized? Have your wages been garnished? Are you being audited by the IRS? Are they sending you letters that demand actions and have urgent due dates? Well, solving your tax problems is as easy as calling Taxes 321. The IRS is the largest collection agency in the world. You need the best representation to give you peace of mind. You need experienced professionals that can cut through the red tape and stop the collection process. If you have a serious problem with the IRS, call the Taxes 321 Network today. We'll get them off your back.
800-511-3022. 800-511-3022. 800-511-3022. 800-511-3022.
Welcome back to the world of Lori Zook. I am very privileged today. I have the honor of speaking with legendary jazz vibraphonist Terry Gibbs. Now, Terry, I'm going to jump right back in here because you've just made me hysterical. With your stories are fantastic. Your book, Good Vibes, wonderful. I felt like I lived with it. You've played in a lot of different formats. You've been a soloist. You've headed up sextets. You've played with bands. Can you maybe describe for listeners who don't know a lot, you know, from being a musician, what is the difference between those two things? And what did you like doing best?
Well, to start with, when you have a big band, a 16-piece band, not only are you a band leader, but you're a psychiatrist. You're running an organization. Yeah, when you're dealing with 16 different personalities. To start with, the band that was called the Dream Band, a big band I had. Now, the way I was thinking, that band is today. And since 1986, even though we recorded this thing in 1959, it's been a cult figure up and around the world, to where the arrangements for that band are being sold all over the world, and the records. Now, Lori, I get, like, not big royalty, but $200, $300, $400 every 3 months from records that I did with the Dream Band that came out in 1986, that were done in 1959. Wow. They're still selling around the world. So running a big band, I say, you see what I say, psychiatrist, you're dealing with 16 different personalities. And the moment they come into work, what I would do, I'd meet everybody at the door, and within 3-4 minutes, if they had a fight with their wife, their mind would be right into the music. I would try to get their minds into what we're going to do now. Forget about what happened the whole day. We're going to have fun out. And with a sextet, and that... You get a chance to play, but not so much. What you do is you rely on the people you hire, like the arrangers. Even though I do a lot of composing, I have a staff of arrangers that wrote for me. And, of course, I sketched a lot of the things we did. I told them what I wanted and exactly how I wanted, and sometimes I changed things. But that's running an organization. With a sextet, it's a lot looser. You get up, you have little arrangements you play. I write all the arrangements. But it's a lot loose. Everybody can't get a chance to play a lot of jazz. Everybody does. You know, you get a chance. We're in a big band. You don't get a lot of chance. You play a lot of ensembles. And if the music is good, the musicians don't mind doing that. Even though they're all jazz musicians, everybody wants to play solos. But if it's good music, they don't mind playing the music and playing solos here and there. But in a little band, everybody gets a chance to play. And I like playing better with a little group, because I get a chance to stretch out, what they call stretch out, and play a little more. But the big band I had that was called the Dream Band, that was a one of a kind. Even though the band that I put together today or last week, or it's called the Dream Band because the music is always the band was called the Dream Band, so all that music is called the Dream Music Dream Band. But playing with my little group is a little more fun, because I get a chance to really, what they say, play 3, 4, 5, 5, 10 choruses if I want to, you know.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I want to play. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Does it make any sense what I said to you? Can you understand?
Yes. No, I definitely understand. And what I want to do, Terry, is we're gonna play another audio clip. Jeff, what are we going to play?
Dipsy Doodle.
Dipsy Doodle.
Oh, that was pretty wild, Jeff. It is, yes.
Now, Terry, that was called Dipsy Doodle. Tell us about that.
That was a pretty wild day. When I first moved out to California, a record company approached me and said, would you like to do a record date? I said, well, what should we do? They said, well, how would you like to do a date with two other vibe players? Now, you got to understand, I came out here fairly well-known, and these two other vibe players were great players that really weren't that well-known. So some people would say that's taking a chance playing with some heavyweight players, and they're liable to play better than you. But there's no But I don't think that way, Steve.
Okay.
I don't ever think who's going to play. I just think about how I played. And Victor Feldman, who was on that date, who became one of my favorite vibe players of all time, and Larry Bunker, who was a great vibe player and a great drummer, were the two best vibe players in California at the time. And we got together and had so much fun doing the date. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, you just played. I haven't heard that thing in a long time. And it was, wow, Marty Page, who wrote for my big band, he wrote those arrangements. And really, we had more laughs because we all played the same instruments and we all had fun. There was no competition because we all loved each other, you know? And that's part of what I do. When I do a record date or I have people working with me, I like to laugh and I like to have fun. And you can have I like to do this all when we're not playing. But once we play, you must be serious about the music. If like for example, with my big band, I have had a bunch of idiots in the band who all had big, great sense of humor. And when I was about ready to tap off the song I'm going to play, and if one of them had some funny to say or something, and start saying, I'd stop and I'd be the best straight man ever in the world, and I would prod him along to be funny and have some laughs so that we can get the audience laughing before we even play and everybody having a good time, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the one I like to do with my bands.
And I reading your book, it sounded like you just had a great time at everything that you did. You warmed them up by the laughing, but then the music was just wonderful.
The music has to be serious. And, you know, why not be on a bandstand like you are at home if you're going to jam, have a jam session in your house? Why not be, instead of being stiff, of course we all show up dressed nice and neat and on time. That's very important. Taking care of the business part is good. But once you get on stage, why not have fun? By the way, if you hear the Dream Band, if there are six CDs with the Dream Band, all of them, you hear guys screaming and laughing and having fun. Now, these are live record dates we did. But so long as they played, everybody was cheering for each other. And the most important thing, they play the heck out of the music, Laurie. So, but the fun had a lot to do with it. Because, you know, now nobody's stiff, nobody's afraid of what the band leader is going to say to them. In the old days, some band leaders, Benny Goodman was very hard on his musicians. A lot of people were, you know. And it didn't work that way with me. I worked very loose.
Now,
working with Steve Allen was even making it looser because he ad-libbed his whole all the TV shows, even the scripted shows he would ad-lib on.
Got it. Yeah, and I want to talk about Steve Allen in a moment, but I want to go back for a moment because in your book you mentioned a fella, I think his name was Wally Heider, H-E-I-D-E-R.
Right.
He changed the way that recordings were made, right?
Yes, in a way, I helped him a little bit. I wanted to do a live record date with the Dream Band, which wasn't called the Dream Band at the time, and I'll tell you how that thing came about. Somebody told me about this guy Wally Heider, who was his hobby was he was an attorney from Portland, I think, whose father was a big attorney, but he stuttered, so he couldn't really work. An attorney doing that, but his hobby was recording, going around. He had this truck with all this great equipment and recording bands live for a hobby. And I heard about him, so I asked him if he'd like to come down and audition for me. And so what he did, he came down and recorded the band first night. Now, I don't care what somebody else wants to hear. I don't care. I only want what I want to hear. Right or wrong, in fact, when I used to conduct television shows, I always told my band, gentlemen, please follow me. And if I'm wrong, follow me anyhow, because if we're all wrong together, we're going to sound right.
Right.
You know? I used to tell that to him. So Wally Heider, he came in and it did the thing, and it was like 95% or 94% of what I was looking for. He was very good. He was great. And I said, Wally, let's do this again tomorrow. I'm going to come back. I want to play something for you. And those days, it was very hard picking out an individual instrument when you record him to really get that, you know, be above the band, because if he's playing a solo. But Wally Heider found a way to do that. But I wanted to hear on the bass, I wanted to hear all the bass notes instead of hear boom, 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 boom. And you couldn't have a special mic for him, but that's what I wanted to hear. So I brought Wally Heider a record by Duke Ellington of a bass player called Jimmy Blanton, who recorded a song called Jack the Bear, where you could hear every note. I said, Wally, that's what I want to hear. And I said, you hear all the trumpets, you know, the lead trumpet player, he plays all the leads, sticks out and sounds like he says, yeah. I said, well, that's not what I want. I want the fourth trumpet player and the second and third to sound just as loud as him. I want to hear a chord with the four trumpets. I don't want anybody sticking out. And plus, I don't want to feel the drums. The drums are the excitement of the band. Put them up front so you can hear the drums. And that's what he did, and believe it or not, he went on to record Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and a whole bunch of people using what I gave him from what I wanted.
Well, thanks for sharing that story. I found that to be very interesting because it changed the way that recordings were done, I'm sure.
Ollie Heider was, that word genius is too loosely used, but he was close to being a genius in recording. In fact, even today, you go in a recording studio and you mention names of these young people who are recording, and everybody knows about him because of what he did, all of what he live recorded.
Now, Terry, I want to mention, you also won the Downbeat and Metronome polls. And didn't you win, like, Downbeat for years? Talk about that a little bit.
5 years in a row, I won the Downbeat and the Metronome. Actually, after the first 2 years, I think, after a bunch of years, went out of business. But I won that poll. And the biggest drag about now with Downbeat, I have these plaques that they give you. They give you an award, they give you a plaque. With the Metronome, when you win that poll, they bring in all the winners and you make a record, which you don't have anything to show for it, to put on your wall for what you did, you know. But, and the worst part about it, when you show up at the record date, everybody looks at each other and says, why did he win? Somebody else should have won. It's like the most strained up record date. Right. You get a bunch of musicians that really, some of them know each other, some don't. Some think somebody else should have won instead of you. But it comes off. But it comes up because you got great musicians all the time.
Yeah, I know you won a lot of awards, but you know something else interesting from your book. You played with women musicians, which were probably not that common in that time. Terry Pollard and Alice. I'm thinking it's McLeod. But you know, what was it like to play with women?
The way, Alice McLeod became Alice Coltrane. I was a matchmaker on that marriage.
That's right, with John Coltrane. Right.
I had three piano players. Terry Pollard, by the way, the first record you played, you took it off a TV show that we did with Steve Allen. I brought Terry Pollard, a young black girl. I brought her into my band in 1953. I think she was 22, 21. I heard her play in Detroit. She was amazing. I mean, there was no girl playing piano at all those days. There aren't many female musicians back then anyhow. And the first day I brought her to New York, Charlie Parker, the greatest musician, offered her a job. He offered her a job every day that week we were there. Anyhow, she was my band for 4 years. And you know what? I hire musicians by how they play it. I don't care if they're black, green, have two heads, and orange, yellow. Who cares? They got 3 feet. I just want the best player on stage. You know what? There's a book, a magazine, actually, where I'm on the cover of the magazine on my music stand near my vibes, and the caption is, you're only as good as what's behind you. I can't play good unless I have good players. Nowhere, because if I don't hear something coming from them, I can't play because I'm not getting anything. It's like playing with terrible musicians, and that's not fun. And so I had three girls, Terry Pollard, then I hired Pat Moran, and then Alice and McLeod, who became Alice Coltrane, after I was the matchmaker on that marriage with her and John Coltrane.
All right, now, you know, talking about way back when, you know, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, segregation policies were still in effect. And so you had a lot of African-American performers that couldn't stay in the hotel, right? And I look at it...
I was almost... Let me tell you, seriously, I was almost beat up or killed those days. I never thought about it, really. I'm going to tell you a story where I was almost killed. And I'm going to use words that maybe they don't use on television... I mean, on radio, but you have to tell you like it is. And I'll tell you, this story is, anyhow, we played in this club down south, and the owner of the place, he had these two goons sitting around, three goons sitting with him, and I came off the stage, and he said, Terry, you know what? This is when Terry Pollard was my band, first girl. He says, you know, you're the greatest attraction I ever had in my place. I'll give you 16 weeks a year. You know, that those days, 16 weeks a year, that meant that you were working one-third of the year, you know. 16 weeks a year if you get rid of that coon on piano, talk about. Let me tell you how fast this went down, because when I used to box, I used to get this burning feeling in my system, and when I got that, I was a good fighter. And anyhow, here's how it went down. The story went down. He says, Terry, you get rid of that coon. No, he says, I'll give you 16 weeks if you get rid of that coon on piano. And I said, you know what? I'll get rid of that coon on piano if you get rid of that fat wife of yours. Now, let me, when I tell you, because I have a dumb mouth to start with, that you won't believe these goons. And him, after I said that, I thought that he's going to take an arm off me or a leg. But I just walked away.
Yeah, and it's sad, because if you look at it, the musicians that all get along together, it doesn't matter what color they are, they all get along. And that should set an example for the rest of the world.
I wasn't trying to set example. I just wanted to have fun playing, and I wanted to play with the best musicians. And it so happened that two of my musicians were black, or whatever, African-American, whatever you want to call them today. Their names changed so much, it doesn't even make any sense. Anyhow, they were two players I had in my band that were great, and they happened to be there because they were great, and I wanted to play with them.
Right.
And both of them were, Terry Powell was my band 4 years, and Herman Wright was my band 3 years. And I think the only thing that kept me alive in some of those places, I had a white drummer and two black, she was black and so was Herman, and a lot of places they thought maybe she was Herman's wife or his girl, so they didn't bother me. Otherwise, I would have gotten killed a million times. But I really never cared about the story. I wanted to play with the best players.
Well, you know what? Speaking of that, I'm going to have Jeff play another audio clip of you. So let's find out what we're going to play.
What's play now? God, you surprised me with all the audio.
I love to surprise you.
Begin the begin.
Well, I'm going to surprise you and say goodbye.
No. Stay. All right, Terry, you're still with me, right?
I sure am, yeah.
Oh, good. I mean, I love listening to you. You played with Steve Allen. You taught Steve Allen, right?
Yeah, you know, it's wild. Before I ever conducted with Steve, back in the 50s, Steve was a big fan of mine. He used to come and hear me play all the time, and he plays piano, so I have him come up and sit and play the piano. And then when I got to Moore, I showed him a few things on the vibes, and then before I ever conducted for him, he asked me if I wanted, he's going to Las Vegas, put an act together, asked if I wanted to be a performer, not conduct, just play what I was going to play. I also played two-finger piano. I was going to play the first song on a ballad, a beautiful ballad, and then play I Got Rhythm and that. And then he's going to come up and play vibes with me, which I taught him. I taught him a whole bunch of things with hand stick all over the place, you know. A lot of choreography, what we did. And it broke up the place, and boy, really, I knew I was a winner, because when we go out the stage door, people would say, Mr. Allen, I never knew you played the vibes that good. Never say a word to me, just say, do that. But that was great, because I wasn't there to make him look bad, I was there to make him look good. But then later on, like I said, he asked me if I wanted to perform as an artist, and I said, who's conducting the show? He said, they have the house band leader in Las Vegas. I said, you want me to conduct the show? He said, I can't pay you any more money if you want to do it. So I did it, and I conducted him. Then he came to me while we were in Las Vegas and said, listen, I'm starting a new TV show. You want to be musical director? I said, yeah. We got together. And for 17 years, that's what I was, a musical director.
That's amazing. Now, I read that you did 65 albums and you've composed over 300 songs?
No, it's not anymore. By now it's about 75 or 80.
Wow. Do you
since I wrote the book.
Now, do you still play?
No, I actually, last October, I quit playing. No, I'll tell you what's wild, Laurie. There's a thing out here in California, what they do every year. They call it a Vibe Summit, and they honor a Vibe Player of the Year. And I was on it when they first started the thing. But the lady who's the president, her name is Flip Mann, she called me and says, can you, because I quit playing last October. There's nothing I want to do, Laurie, that I hate to say it this way, but that I haven't done with better players. We don't have Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, Oscar Peterson. I go down the line with musicians that we don't have anymore. So I've done everything I wanted to do, and I don't mind doing nothing now, because I still hear a lot of music in my head, and I go from my little office into the living room to watch TV, and I have to pass my Vibe, and when I go pass it, I hear something, I play for about 5 or 10 minutes, and it sounds fairly decent, I feel good, that's the end of that, you know.
Yeah, you did it. You did it for you, and it just happened to work out. Everybody else loved it.
Yes, I always did it for me. I can say I'm a very blessed human being, really.
Yes, and you're so personable and so funny, and I'm so glad and honored that you were willing to do the show with me. Now, you have a website, Terry.
Are we doing a show? I guess we thought you and I were having a conversation.
Oh, yeah, we are. But you, I want to talk about your website. You have a website. It's Terry Gibbs, GIBBS.com.
Yes.
Okay, yes. That way people
you go
can...
If you want to see some videos, if you go on the internet and put in Terry Gibbs Vibes, V-I-B-E-S, videos, you'll get to a bunch of the videos that we've done. By the way, the thing that you played, the first one, came off a video that I put on Facebook about 5 or 6 years ago when Terry Pollard died. That was a Steve Allen show that we did, and that came off that show, right? Is that where you got that
video?
Yes.
I went onto YouTube and I looked through everything, but I didn't just pick the first page. I went through multiple pages.
By the way, also, because you would it's an audio, I mean, you have an audio thing, but if you watch the thing, you can see it on Terry Gibbs Vibes videos. This is a TV show we did with Steve Allen. She also plays Vibes with me. And she was, when I tell you that I don't think there's a young Vibe player playing today that played as good jazz on Vibes as Terry Pollard did. In 1953, played that good.
Yeah, it's
played almost as good as I did.
Well, you've been such a pleasure to have. So we're gonna sign off, Terry. I want to thank you again so much. But we're gonna sign off. We're gonna play a little bit more of your music.
I didn't tell you about my list.
Will you do another show with me down the road?
I'll do another one with you, Laurie.
Great. Thank you again, Terry. I appreciate it.
It was fun, Laurie.
All right. Thanks.